Everybody, from the learned historian to the school child, can name the men who were the leaders of the American Revolution and help create the documents that are the basis of our government. These forefathers, as we call them, include such greats as Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock, George Washington, and John Adams. But what many people don't know is that our forefathers had a forefather, a man whose political theories and writings inspired and guided the American revolutionaries from concept to constitution. His name was John Locke. Even the very wording of our Declaration of Independence was in part taken from the writings of Locke. The famous phrase, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," was originally written by Jefferson to read, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." But Franklin scratched out "sacred and undeniable" and scrawled over it the words of John Locke. Even though he died over 70 years before Paul Revere's ride, John Locke played as critical a role in the American Revolution as any of our forefathers, and he played an equally strong role in the French Revolution, which followed 13 years later. Today, his writings still endure as some of the most influential and provocative in the history of philosophy. The man who gave the impetus to both the French and American revolutionaries was himself an Englishman. According to John Locke, he was born in a storm. This wasn't a reference to the weather that day of August 29, 1632, when he came into the world, but to the political turbulence rocking his homeland of England. The 17th century in England was a period in which the role of the monarchy and the character and relationship between ruler and subject were topics of constant debate, conflict, and doubt. It was an age of transition, one in which the Western world's view of government, politics, and human rights would be completely transformed. In the 1600s, Protestants and Catholics were locked in power struggles and conflicts throughout Europe, and England was no exception. The period of John Locke's childhood was the time of a 10-year civil war between England's king, Charles I, and the Puritans. Locke's father, a lawyer, fought on the Puritan side as a captain in an army raised by a landowner named Alexander Popham. It was a good side to be on. Not only did the Puritans win, but when they did, Popham, now a friend of the Locks, was in a position of influence. He used that influence to help get Captain Locke's son, John, into the prestigious Westminster School, where he could ground himself in the classics and prepare for college. At Westminster, most of the teachers were still loyal to the king, and they passed those royalist sentiments on to their students. Locke, raised in a Calvinist family and son of a captain in the Puritan army, was suddenly surrounded by people of the other side. When Charles I was executed in nearby Whitehall, the entire school, faculty and student body alike, was filled with indignation. Locke, too, felt sympathy, even though his own father had fought against the king. After Westminster, Locke left to enroll at Oxford, where he was now in the opposite setting. The faculty was ruled by Puritans. All this early exposure to both Royalists and Puritans gave Locke an understanding and respect for elements of each side, but it also gave him a lifelong distaste for extremism of any kind, whether political or religious. His exposure to this extremism was laying the groundwork for his future writings on religious tolerance. Locke didn't like Oxford very much. He found the curriculum, rhetoric, grammar, moral philosophy, geometry, and Greek, to be uninspired. To make up for it, he spent his free time pursuing his own interests, experimental science and medicine. About this time, Locke inherited a small portion of his father's estate, which came with a modest yearly income that gave him a little more independence. After graduation, Locke was offered a post teaching Greek and philosophy at Oxford, in Christ Church, the most important college in the university, and one that was more politically mixed than the rest of the campus. He accepted the position, even though he had no intention of making a career out of teaching. One of Locke's colleagues at Christ Church was a man named Edward Bagshaw, who published a pamphlet advocating religious tolerance, political liberty, and natural rights, ideas he felt free to express now that the king had been overthrown, and ideas which would later make Locke famous. But at this time, still in his early 20s, Locke attacked Bagshaw's ideas and even maintained that a government had the right to enforce religious conformity. Unfortunately for Bagshaw, the monarchy of England was reinstated with the restoration of Charles II, and he was expelled from the university, thrown into Newgate Prison, and died shortly after his release. By the time his friend Bagshaw had been destroyed for his political beliefs, Locke had undergone a transformation. This happened partly because he met and made friends with a man named Anthony Ashley Cooper, later known as the Earl of Shaftesbury. Shaftesbury was the leading liberal politician of his time and an outspoken champion of religious freedom. He had spoken out in Parliament against every bill that came along which threatened the rights of those who didn't conform with the ruling government. Shaftesbury wasn't exactly what one would expect in a mentor or role model. He was described as small, ugly, very vain, and untrustworthy. There were also stories that he kept brothels as a sideline. He was a forceful, aggressive politician who had made many enemies, some of them in very respectable circles, such as the poet laureate of England, John Dryden. But in spite of these failings, he was an intellectual with a deep interest in science and philosophy, and he spent his entire career trying to expand the liberties of English citizens. He stood firmly for all the same issues that Locke supported: a constitutional monarchy, Protestant succession to the throne, civil liberty, religious tolerance, the rule of Parliament, and the economic expansion of Britain. It was inevitable the two would hit it off from the start. Locke and Shaftesbury became such good friends that Locke moved into Shaftesbury's elegant house in London, where he served as his private physician. Locke had become a physician almost by default. At Christ's Church, he had been required to teach the philosophy of Aristotle, which he considered a waste of time. His passion for natural science was growing deeper, but he hadn't been allowed to use the laboratory, except on rare occasions. Finally, he'd taken up medicine, partly because it was the one field in which the church wouldn't require him to take holy orders. Even though Locke was never able to obtain his doctorate in medicine, he did receive a license, and Shaftesbury took him on as his private doctor. Soon he was glad he did. Locke saved his life when he had a silver tube inserted to drain a cyst in Shaftesbury's liver. Shaftesbury wore that tube for the rest of his life, but being the dandy he was, he soon had the silver one replaced with a gold one. This operation convinced Shaftesbury that Locke was a genius who needed only to find his calling. He urged him to read philosophy, including René Descartes, introduced him to eminent thinkers and philosophers, and inspired him to read economic and political theory. These explorations into human thought inspired Locke to write the first draft of his masterpiece, Essay Concerning Human Understanding, which he composed while staying at Shaftesbury's house. That was just the first draft, however. The final draft would take 20 more years. Locke lived with Shaftesbury on and off until Shaftesbury died in 1683, when Locke was 51 years old. During those 15 years, he served not just as Shaftesbury's physician, but as his advisor on general affairs. He also held minor political posts and became embroiled in the fiery politics of his time. Shaftesbury entrusted Locke with a variety of tasks: negotiating his son's marriage to the daughter of an earl, serving as secretary of the group that had been formed to increase trade with America, and helping to write a constitution for the new American colony of Carolina, one which gave freedom of worship to all colonists and denied admission only to atheists. While all this was going on, Locke also became a fellow of the Royal Society, the leading scientific organization of England. Meanwhile, Shaftesbury had risen to the ranks of Lord High Chancellor of England. He established the Council of Trade and Plantations and made Locke its secretary. Steadily, they were gaining more power and influence together. Locke was a handsome man, mysterious and even romantic, who took elaborate care to guard his anonymity as a political writer. He invented all kinds of secret codes, adopted a form of shorthand that only he could read, and sometimes even used invisible ink. He was, in his own way, a man of deep faith. He believed there was divine order to the universe, and he also believed in the prospect of life after death. But he did not believe in miracles, and he had little tolerance for people who based their knowing on mystical experiences or visions. Even though he was a scholar, Locke had nothing but contempt for intellectuals and academics who isolated themselves from real life, people whom he said converse with but one sort of men and read but one sort of books. To Locke, like Karl Marx, the philosopher should live in the world of action and associate with people active in human affairs. He himself would have liked a post as ambassador or some other administrative job with responsibility. But he never felt his health could withstand it. He suffered from asthma from middle age on. Instead of accepting lofty positions that were physically rigorous, he gave much of his time to the Board of Trade, which, in fact, he helped establish. Locke had little patience with people who wasted their time on trivial pursuits. He clearly and rather sarcastically demonstrated that once when his friend Shaftesbury introduced him to two noblemen and scholars who were guests at Shaftesbury's house for the evening. Rather than engage in conversation, the men sat down and began a game of cards. Locke said nothing, but began to scribble in his notebook. Some time later, the nobleman, overcome with curiosity, asked Locke what he was doing. He responded, "My lords, I am endeavoring as far as possible to profit by my present situation. For having waited with impatience for the honor of being in company with the greatest geniuses of the age, I could do nothing better than to write down your conversation. And indeed I have set down the substance of what you have said for this hour or two." Embarrassed and suitably chastised, the noblemen set aside their game. Although he was naturally emotional and could be hot-tempered, Locke demonstrated much control and self-discipline. He was very orderly and careful about money, and sometimes a bit of a tightwad. His habits were temperate. He never overdrank or overate or overspent. Probably his greatest indulgence was his friends. Locke was a man for whom friendship was a necessity, and the more, the better. Although he never married or had a family, he had a great love for children, and some of his friends sought his advice on the raising of their own sons and daughters. Locke's first bout of asthma occurred when he was about 43, and, believing he had consumption or tuberculosis, he went to France for a cure. He stayed for 3 years, making friends with many of that country's leading thinkers and scientists. While he traveled around France, he studied its great works of civil engineering, its agriculture, and also the way its king treated his Protestant subjects. What he saw was that the few rights they had were gradually being taken away, either through legal means or by trickery. He began to formulate even more ideas about the role of a monarchy and the rights of the people. Upon his return to England in 1679, at the age of 47, Locke found his country torn by dissension. Shaftesbury, who was still in power, was in the middle of the turmoil and just about to meet his downfall. Locke stood by while his friend got himself into all kinds of political trouble and finally had to flee the country. The source of the dissension was the continuing power struggle between Protestants and Catholics, and the source of Shaftesbury's trouble was his zeal for Protestantism. Even though he was an advocate of tolerance, he had a little difficulty with his own tolerance, especially of Catholics, whom he felt had aligned themselves with England's enemies. In this case, that basically meant France, a Catholic country that was England's biggest rival in trade. When the king, Charles II, refused to deny his Catholic brother, James, the right to succeed him on the throne, Shaftesbury tried to start a rebellion. The rebellion was unsuccessful. When Locke arrived home, Shaftesbury had already been imprisoned in the Tower of London for a year, but had just been released. There was a trial, and he was acquitted, but because of continuing danger, Shaftesbury was forced to escape to the liberal country of Holland, where he died soon afterwards. All of these events are what led up to Locke's chief work of political theory, called Two Treatises of Government. The book wasn't published until 6 years after Shaftesbury's death, by which time most of England had come to agree with him and had taken up arms to expel the Catholic Prince James. In his place, they demanded the crown for the king's Protestant nephew, William of Orange. Locke's book dealt with the vital question of whether a people were entitled to rise up against their king, a question he raised before the rebellion and wisely kept unpublished until after it had been successful. Even then, he published the work anonymously and continued to keep his authorship secret, even when his ideas had become popular. Locke was not a man who took chances. After Shaftesbury was exiled, not one of his friends was now safe in Great Britain. Locke returned to Oxford for a while, but he soon realized that his colleagues were spying on him. When efforts to root out all of Shaftesbury's friends and supporters reached a fever pitch, Locke followed in his patron's footsteps. He fled to Amsterdam. The years of exile in Holland were far from wasted years. In general, Locke was very happy in Holland, although he was distressed to hear that King Charles had commanded that he be expelled from his post at Oxford, a post that was supposed to be for life. Locke spent the bulk of his time in Holland conferring with other scholars and writing. He completed Essay Concerning Human Understanding, which he'd started back at Shaftesbury's house when he was a young man, and this time he published his work under his real name. The result was immediate fame throughout the Western world, but neither his fame nor his exile in Holland brought him safety. Back in England, the ruler now was James II, the Catholic Shaftesbury and Locke had so strongly opposed. There had been another rebellion while Locke was away, and King James became convinced that Locke had been involved in absentia. Britain sent Holland a list of 84 traitors wanted by the English government, and there in the Els was the former teacher from Oxford, John Locke. He was forced to go into hiding in Holland, living under a pseudonym at the house of a friend. Then, a few years later, the power in England shifted again when English Protestants invited William of Orange to invade their country and rescue them from King James. William promptly obliged, taking the throne for himself. Now that a Protestant was back on the throne, Locke was safe. But because of ill health, he decided to stay in Holland a while longer. He returned in 1689 when he was 57, having been in exile for 5 years. When he arrived, he was in the company of the Princess of Orange, William's wife, and the new Queen Mary II. Locke's asthma was still giving him difficulty, and he found the London air seemed to aggravate it. Therefore, soon after he returned to England, he chose a home in the countryside of Essex, where the air was cleaner. This time he stayed in the house of an aristocratic couple named Sir Francis and Lady Masham. Locke never owned his own home and relied on patrons during his entire career. They were easy to find. His friendships with prominent government officials and scholars made him one of the most influential men of the 17th century. And now that William of Orange was King of England, Locke was a favorite at court. At the Masham estate, Locke entered into what he considered a semi-retirement, taking little part in public life and even refusing an ambassadorial post. Instead, he spent his time reading, writing, and talking with his visitors, who included the great astronomer Isaac Newton. Newton and Locke particularly liked to discuss the letters or epistles of St. Paul. Locke compared himself to this new friend whom he called the incomparable Mr. Newton, saying that in an age of geniuses such as this, it was enough for him, humble Mr. Locke, to, in his words, be employed as an under-laborer in clearing the ground a little and removing some of the rubbish that lies in the way of knowledge. There are many who would say he did much, much more. It was in these last quiet years of his life that Locke had the satisfaction of seeing much that he'd hoped for England coming true. A Protestant was on the throne. England became a constitutional monarchy ruled by Parliament. Advances were made in equality in the legal systems, and bills were passed assuring more religious tolerance and freedom of thought and expression. Locke himself wrote the arguments that were used in the House of Commons to push through an act that guaranteed freedom of the press. Until his death, Locke also wrote on a broad range of subjects, including educational reform, civil rights, and religious tolerance. His last years at Essex were like a peaceful retreat. Besides the many friends who visited, Locke was very much at home with his host and hostess, the Mashams, and felt like one of the family. He died on October 28, 1704, at the age of 72. Lady Masham wrote, "His death was like his life, truly pious, yet natural, easy, and unaffected." Locke was known and is still admired today for his two greatest works, An Essay Concerning Human Understanding and Two Treatises on Government. The first of these works, The Essay Concerning Human Understanding, he started when he was 39 years old and completed and published almost 20 years later when he was 58. In this essay, Locke provided what might be the first modern philosophy of science. The book had its origin in a series of discussions with friends that led Locke to believe that the principal subject of philosophy had to be the extent of the mind's ability to know. He set out, in his words, "to examine our abilities and to see what objects our understandings were or were not fitted to deal with." He started the essay by refuting the concept that the mind is equipped with innate ideas, ideas that are part of the mind from birth, not learned or acquired later from outside sources. Locke claimed that all ideas were placed in the mind as a result of experience. The essay is a book in which the word idea appears over and over. But an idea to Locke isn't just a thought. It's also what we hear, smell, taste, or feel. To Locke, the mind starts as a blank slate and then forms a content or ideas based on experiences. The ideas are of two types: outer ideas, or those of sensation which come from the observation of the outside world, and inner ideas, those of reflection, which arise when the mind observes itself and thinks about its own mental processes. These are the only sources of knowledge. Therefore, as we think and speculate, we can never go beyond the confines of what we've gathered through sensation and reflection. "It seems probable to me," he wrote, "that the simple ideas we receive from sensation and reflection are the boundaries of our thoughts, beyond which the mind, whatever efforts it would make, is not able to advance one jot, nor can it make any discoveries when it would pry in the nature and hidden causes of those ideas." This philosophical doctrine is called empiricism. It holds that all knowledge is derived from experience, whether of the mind or senses. Locke is considered the founder of British empiricism, which later became the dominant tradition in British philosophy. It began its rise just as experimental science, which also relied on observation and experience, began its rise. To Locke, people aren't really aware of the physical objects around them. They don't really see the objects. They're only aware of the ideas these objects give rise to within their mind, ideas that represent the objects. These ideas may hold some qualities of the object, but they don't duplicate it. This theory that the mind is confined and can't go beyond its own sensation and reflection is why Locke called on his readers to give up speculation and turn instead to the practical activities of living. Since there's no hope we can understand the nature of things, we might as well direct our thoughts instead to what he describes as the improvement of such arts and inventions, engines, and utensils as might best contribute to our conveniency and delight. As a philosopher, it was Locke's goal to get away from imagination, from blind adherence to tradition, from mysticism and vague visionary insights, and get down to the hard, plain, measurable facts. He was practical. He was utilitarian. He saw no sense on wasting time in matters we could never understand, when we could get to work right now on what needed our attention. He set the stage for all those practical workers of the modern world, the scientists, technologists, industrialists, inventors, who focused their time and talents on the concrete, material world and not on an abstract world that can, to Locke, be endlessly debated but never grasped. He set the stage, too, for the American Revolution, which, although not without ideals, was one of the most practical revolutions in history, driven by some of the most practical and grounded men. No one was more focused on the world of activity, of things, of invention, of science, than Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson. The same year he published his Essay on Human Understanding, 1690, was also the year Locke released Treatises of Government. In this work, he championed the rights of men against the rights of kings, and justified his arguments by using both the scriptures and by an analysis of society and the basis of political obligations. Locke suggested that societies have made an agreement in which they trade their natural state of anarchy for a commonwealth ruled by law. This is the social contract idea, which was explored many times both before and after Locke, and which also made Rousseau famous. Unlike others who preceded him, Locke treats the social contract as a fact of history, something that has actually happened. It's not a theory or a model or an idea. To him, it's reality, that humans once lived in anarchy and banded together to form political societies. Locke has a very positive, even Christian, view of humanity. He sees people as reasonable beings subject to the rule of natural law, which is the same as the law of God. In their original natural state, Locke believed people were happy, reasonable, and tolerant. They were also equal and free to pursue what he termed life, health, liberty, and possessions. Out of their freedom, they formed civil societies for the exact purpose of protecting those rights. This theory differed from philosophers before him, who said instead that people give up these rights when they form societies. No, Locke said, they form a contract with their rulers that implies they will trust the rulers to guard these rights. And, most importantly, if the rulers renege on the contract, then the people have the right to claim it's invalid. They have more than a right, in fact. People are sometimes obligated to withdraw their support. In other words, he gave people the right to revolution, a right they would take to heart in the following century in both America and France. Locke didn't always use the precise term revolution. What he did say was that people have the right to appeal to heaven in certain circumstances, such as when a ruler has ceased to respect their rights. Then he felt it was justifiable for the people to resort to force and replace the unjust government with one that was just. This right to revolution, however, should be reserved for only the most critical and insoluble situations. It was John Locke, too, who first set down the system of checks and balances that was later included in the Constitution of the United States. He thought the role of government should be limited, just as Thomas Jefferson believed, and that different branches of the government would serve as watchdogs on the other branches. A legislature would maintain the government limitations and protect individual liberties. Much of the liberal, social, economic, and ethical theories of the 18th century had their source in Locke's writings about the social contract. It's easy to see why John Locke is often called the prophet of democracy and the philosopher of freedom. It's clear, too, how his writings inspired the revolutionaries of both America and France. Thomas Jefferson, writer of the Declaration of Independence, freely acknowledged the debt he owed Locke for many of the ideas that shaped the American Republic. Yet Locke's influence in France was even greater. The political tyranny of the French monarchy became suddenly outdated when the writings of John Locke appeared on the scene. With Locke's liberal politics, Newton's scientific principles, and free trade and economics, England seemed like the model nation to the French. Throughout the 18th century, French thought was dominated by Anglophilia, a worship of the British, that was built above all else on the influence of Locke. He kicked off the Age of Enlightenment and Reason, not just at home in England, but on the European continent. Politics was not the only sphere of Locke's influence. His style of religion, tolerant, unfussy, and stripped to the barest doctrine, became the model for Protestants in the 18th century. And his empiricist philosophy, that knowledge comes from direct experience or observation, became of central importance as society moved further into the scientific and industrial age. Locke was not only one of the founders of the Age of Reason, but the one whose influence has been most enduring. He was the ultimate example of the Age of Enlightenment's faith in the middle class, science, and human virtue. That faith, though completely unsupported by his government and times in which he lived, was one to which he remained true and for which he fought his whole adult life in spite of the danger of exile and imprisonment. Locke remains a powerful influence on life and thought in Western civilization, where hundreds of millions of people now live with the rights and liberties he claimed were natural and self-evident.
This is the end of the session.